This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Zoe Kazan, is one of the stars of the HBO series The Plot Against America, which is adapted from the Philip Roth novel by David Simon and Ed Burns, who also created the HBO series The Wire. Zoe Kazan was also in the David Simon HBO series The Deuce. She co-starred in the film The Big Sick with Kumail Nanjiani, and she wrote the film Ruby Sparks, in which she starred with her partner, Paul Dano, with whom she wrote the screen adaptation of the Richard Ford novel Wildlife. She's from a movie family. Her grandfather, Aaliyah Kazan, directed On the Waterfront and A Streetcar Named Desire. Her parents are both screenwriters. Let's start with a scene from The Plot Against America. The story rewrites a turning point in American history. It's set in 1940-42. Franklin Delano Roosevelt has lost the election to Charles Lindbergh, who's considered an American hero because he was the first pilot to fly across the Atlantic. But he's also anti-Semitic, he admires Hitler, and won't enter World War II to fight against Hitler. He's an isolationist. The story focuses on a Jewish family in Newark, New Jersey. Zoe Kazan plays Bess, a wife and mother of two boys. The family is targeted for a Lindbergh administration program to relocate Jews to the so-called heartland under the pretense of helping Jews assimilate and integrate into America. For this family, that would mean relocating to Kentucky. Bess has been trying to convince her husband Herman to join the Jews who've been moving to Canada before it was too late. Although Herman is a passionate Roosevelt supporter and hates Lindbergh, he refuses to leave his own country. But he also refuses to move to Kentucky. Meanwhile, there's an increasing number of attacks on Jews and Jewish stores, and Lindbergh is becoming more fascistic. In this scene, Bess and Herman have been listening to a radio broadcast by Walter Winchell, the famous syndicated gossip columnist who's been mounting a presidential campaign to oppose Lindbergh and has been attacking Lindbergh on his radio show. Bess's husband, Herman, played by Morgan Spector, has decided to write a letter to Winchell to get him to publicly protest the relocation program. Zoe Kazan, as Bess, speaks first.
What are you doing?
Gonna write to him. Tell him we need him to speak out. In the government telling companies where people of this race, that religion, where they can and can't work? You let him get away with that, what's next? That's how fascism works.
You're sitting there writing to Winchell? Walter Winchell.
Yes, I am.
And you're predicting that these people will stop at nothing once they know what they can get away with. And yet you don't think they can do what they want to the mail?
Come on, Bess, it's one letter.
It's not just one letter. You're also planning to sue the government.
As you said, we have rights.
How can you see what these people are and have so little sense of what they are capable of? We have already had FBI agents harassing us. We have had our children questioned. Let someone else write to Winchell.
Someone else? The next guy?
Yeah. Let the next guy step up.
And I just sit here on my ass, keeping quiet, waiting for the worst to happen.
No, I don't see Shepsy sitting around writing letters waiting for the worst to happen.
Not Canada again.
Yes, Canada.
This is my country.
Not anymore. It is Lindbergh's. It is the Jew haters. It is the America firsters. It is the people who chase children down the street asking questions and then deport their families to Kentucky. It's their country.
And if we run, if we quit, then they win and they do not get to win.
Herman.
We have done nothing wrong.
Zoe Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your performance in The Plot Against America. I just want to start by saying, how are you?
Thank you so much, Terry. I'm all right. I have to say, it seems really small to complain about anything considering what so many people are going through right now. We're doing absolutely fine. We all have our health. I'm staying at my parents' house with my my partner and our child right now, so it's a lot to adjust to, but we're really lucky.
So you were on a set in Australia and your partner Paul Dano was on a set in London. Both productions shut down. So now you and your daughter, your young daughter, are living with your parents. So you're in your childhood home now as a mother.
I am. It's strange, I think, especially because we don't know when we're going to go back home to Brooklyn. we've been gone from there because my job started in November. So we've been gone for 6 months now. And we don't know when we're going to go back because, quote unquote, when this is over, I think we have to go back to our respective jobs, or at least that's what I'm assuming right now. But, you know, all of us are living in such a state of not knowing right now. So I think that that makes it harder than if I knew, like, okay, I'm going to be living with my parents for 6 weeks or whatever. But there's something wonderful, too, about, I mean, it feels like being inside of a dream or something, like giving my daughter baths in the bathtub that my sister and I used to take our baths in, and talking to you right now, sitting on the floor of my childhood closet where I used to, like, talk on the phone to my boyfriend in high school, you know, so it's very strange.
That's pretty funny. So let's talk about the plot against America. Are there parts of the story about living in an America first nation that's becoming very anti-Semitic and increasingly moving toward fascism? Are there parts of that story that resonate for you now? And I should mention, Philip Roth wrote this in, was it 2004?
Yeah, I think that's right. I was kind of taken aback at the parallels that are on the page. I thought, like, oh, when people write about this, they're going to think that David Simon was being, like, ham-fisted in making allusions to our current government and our current situation. But the high majority of them are right there on the page. And like you said, what he wrote more than a decade before Trump came to power. So, yes, it feels like scarily prescient in some ways. And then in other ways, he was just looking back at the history of our country, and we had internment camps in this country in World War II, as you know. So I don't know that he was imagining an America that far off from the one that he thought we were living in.
Are there ways in which the story of the plot against America connects with your family? And I'm thinking here, like, your grandfather, Elia Kazan, who is, you know, a great director, Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront. He was called to testify in 1952 before the House Un-American Activities Committee during the communist witch hunting era, the Joe McCarthy era. And he named some names of Hollywood actors. He gave up names. And, you know, he was a Greek immigrant, and he was accused of possibly being un-American. It was the House Un-American Activities Committee. And, of course, in Plot Against America, the Jews are basically considered by President Lindbergh to be un-American, because if they weren't un-American, why would they have to be relocated in order to better assimilate into America?
That's right.
So I'm wondering if you were thinking about connections between the story and your family, specifically your immigrant grandfather or grandparents.
Yeah, grandfather. My grandmother was like a Mayflower American.
Oh, wow.
okay. Yeah. Yeah, of course I was. I think it's a really apt question. And I want to say that I don't normally like answering questions about my grandfather, particularly about his experiences with the HUAC hearings, partially because it happened so long before I was born. And I by no means feel like an expert, partially because it's such a terrible chapter in our country's history. And I feel a morbid fear of getting something wrong or hurting further the victims of those hearings or their families. And also because my family, the large majority of my family, are incredibly private people who have chosen very private lives. And I never want to feel like a spokesperson for them, or that I'm betraying their trust, or anything of that nature. And that's why it makes me emotional sometimes to talk about it. I think that the parallels are right there. And I couldn't help but think of my own family history. And I mean, frankly, I think I wouldn't be much of an actor if I didn't think about it. It's a strong personal connection to the material. I thought very deeply about my grandparents and their choices and what it must have meant to them to be in that position. And frankly, it helped me, I think, take one step in my, like, personal maturation and actually playing this role and working on this material sort of helped me take steps into, I think, a more adult viewpoint.
So your partner, Paul Dano, he's probably like a little bit older than you?
No, he's 9 months younger than me.
Oh, okay, okay. So you're basically the same age, but you've spoken about how your experiences as actors are so different because of gender. Like, he has auditioned for a lot of roles that require gunplay, or at least having a gun, and
right.
You have not. And you're asked to cry a lot in auditions or in roles, and he is not, although I have mm-hmm. seen him cry in roles. So I'd like to hear more about thinking about the gender differences based on your experiences.
Oh, gosh, it's just so different. I mean, look, I think what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years with the rise of the Me Too movement and that movement becoming kind of central in our cultural imagination and Harvey Weinstein going to jail, and that's all great. And I hope that makes a real big permanent change. But I also know that there's like years and years, eons of patriarchal construction that supports itself that will try to undo that work. I think my experiences, especially in my 20s, were so, so very different than those of my male partner that I can't begin to describe, not just in terms of what opportunities were available to us, but also in terms of the way that we were treated on sets, like the very casual sexism and sexual harassment that I received, which I'm sure is like nothing compared to what some other women have faced, and especially, you know, women of color.
Can you give us an example of something that you consider that kind of casual sexism?
Yeah, I had a co-star say to me in the middle of rehearsal once, "You would be hot if you gained 10 pounds," in a room in which I was the only woman.
Being told by somebody, "Hey, you'd be really hot if you gained 10 pounds," that's a really loaded thing to say to you. That person might not have known you had an eating disorder when you were younger. So
yeah.
to say that is just really... they might have been totally unaware of how problematic that comment was. Have you ever felt like you could say something about like an inappropriate remark or an inappropriate request?
Sure, I think.
I'm not trying to apologize for
that.
No,
them, I feel like I've gained more ability to do so as I've gotten older. And also, frankly, because I need the approval of other people less for both like financial and career reasons, like speaking up for myself and saying I don't feel comfortable doing that, or I'm not going to wear that costume, or whatever it may be. Like, that has definitely gotten easier for me as I've gotten older. But within the last few years, I had a producer send me an email saying, "You sure have such a big brain for such a small body." You know, it's stuff like that that I think, well, I bet he's not sending emails like that to my male co-stars. But I didn't say anything because I didn't want to make him uncomfortable, because I still had to go to work for him for the next few months. You know, it's complicated.
You've spoken about in the past how you've dealt with depression through your life. And I think this is, while we're all like isolating and isolated and anxious and worried, it's kind of like a very fertile ground for depression.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if like you're having to deal with depression coming back because of the anxiety and fears surrounding the pandemic.
You know, I'm very lucky in that I feel like my mental health is in pretty good shape right now. But also, frankly, I don't know that I really have time to check in with myself or let myself have a deep awareness of really how I'm doing, because, you know, we don't have any child care help right now. My parents are both still working because they're screenwriters, and my partner and I are trying to give each other a few hours a day to write, but we're really like, you know, with our kid all the time. She's almost 20 months and she's extraordinarily active. And, you know, we're really lucky because we normally employ a nanny who gives us time to ourselves. and we're without that right now. So to be totally frank, I don't really know 100% what's going on with me mentally, because I'm so tired at the end of the day. We eat dinner, we clean up, and then we get in bed, I do the crossword puzzle, and I go to sleep.
Can I ask you about the eating disorder and how you were able to get past it? Do you connect that with the depression?
Oh, yeah.
And you said that, you know, the eating disorder wasn't because you wanted to like, look thin. Because it sounds
you've never been
that preoccupied with how you look, with clothes and hair and all of that. So what do you think it was about?
I mean, I think it was about control, and I think it was about limiting what I was feeling. You know, like, I was very sad. I was very sad, and I was trying to, I don't know. I have a lot of distance from it now, because I think I got lucky in a lot of ways, and, like, I really got better. Like, I went to therapy, and it worked for me.
So if the eating disorder was about gaining some kind of control over your body, how does acting relate to that, if at all? Because as an actor, your body is your tool, it's your instrument, and you have to control it and basically make it play a different song than when you're just yourself.
The way that my brain connects it up when you asked that question was that I thought, you know, part of my experience of having an eating disorder was that, like, my feelings felt too big for me to handle. And I was trying to, like, dampen them in some way. And I think that having that experience of my emotions as being, like, a great ocean that I, like, cannot always handle is one of the reasons that I wanted to be an actor. Having a place to put my feelings has made me a saner person. You know, acting really functions for me in a cathartic way. So maybe it connects up there. Terry, can I ask you a question?
You can try.
So I was listening to your interviews with Philip Roth before talking to you today, just in preparation. And I thought, like, oh, you interview so many people in this really intimate way, and then they pass, and you often, like, re-air those episodes when they pass. And I thought, oh, it must be such a funny experience for you to have this, like, intimate sort of touch all these people in this intimate way, and then you're touching, like, really famous people that people are then, like, mourning online, but you've had, like, a one-on-one conversation with all these people. Like, did you have a feeling when Philip Roth passed of, like, oh, I know him, I talked to him 7 times, or do people feel, does a person like that still feel like at arm's length to you?
Well, it's a bit of both, because I know, like, Philip Roth and I were not friends. We never met in person. We just had our interviews. But I really love his writing, and felt like those conversations went really well. I mean, I felt like he was just so interesting. So when he died, I thought, well, I was very sad, and I thought, I'll never be able to talk with him again. And I'll never be able to read a new book by him again.
Yeah.
So that, you know, of course, there's still books he's written that I haven't read, because his body of work was so large. So, that's some comfort. But, but you're right. You know, I'm both at arm's length and yet still feel very connected. And one thing I'll say while we're on the subject of re-airing interviews when somebody died is that this is a really fraught period for our show, in the sense that, you know, more people are dying now because of the epidemic, and we've devoted, 2 or 3 Fridays just to obituaries. There was one Friday when I think we had like 3 obituaries on the show, and that just made me really sad, and, you know, we're bracing for more. And so it makes me feel good that we have the interviews that we can play to help remember somebody whose public life, whose work had such meaning for so many people. So it makes me proud we can do that, but it just makes me really, really sad.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I find them to be when someone passes that I really care about and you re-air one of the episodes, it means a lot to me and it makes a space for me to mourn even though I don't know that person.
Well, that's the thing. Like, we might not really know them, but we know their work. And the work is like a manifestation of some of who they are. So it's easy to feel like we know them. And they gave us the gift of their work. So, you know, there's so much to be grateful for. Grateful to them for. Yeah. It's a sad time. Let's be honest. There's just so much sadness in the world right now.
There really is. It's really hard to to do all the things that you need to do in a day and have that like a very pressureful storm cloud just hanging over.
And it's like what you were saying before about being kind of grateful that your toddler is so consuming of your time, because it's exhausting, but it's something, you know, something really wonderful and necessary to focus on.
That's right.
Because you can't just sit around all day thinking about how frightening the virus is and all the people who are sick and the people who have died and fears
and that, lost their health insurance and lost their jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I wish you and your family, your extended family, I wish them well, continued good health. And thank you for taking some time to talk with us. And I really appreciate your work.
Thank you. And to you, Terry, your work means so much to me.
Zoe Kazan is one of the stars of the 6-part HBO adaptation of Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America. The whole series is now on demand and streaming on HBO. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has been thinking about the role books play in challenging times, and she has some recommendations for books that are ready to report for duty.
There's a black and white photo taped on my office door at school, the office I haven't been inside in almost a month. It shows an American soldier stretched out, reading a book. He's reading A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Betty Smith's 1943 novel based on her childhood in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Smith's novel, along with Moby Dick, The Adventures of Superman, and some 122 million copies of novels, essays, and poetry, were printed during World War II and distributed to servicemen. The largest distribution of these so-called armed services editions was on the eve of D-Day. Every man boarding a landing craft was handed a book. Even as an uncertain destiny awaited them, some of these guys, like our friend in that photo, found solace in reading. Books are essential cargo, I believe that. And I want to give a nod to the range of the Armed Services editions by recommending a variety of books, old and new, that appeal to me right now. When I need a mental escape from a stressful situation, I often fantasize about wandering around one of the grand department stores of my New York City childhood, stores like Bonwit Teller and B. Altman. Most of those palaces of consumption are gone, but fortunately, Scribner has recently published the first American edition of a tart, beguiling 1993 department store novel called The Women in Black by Madeline St. John. Set in the 1950s, it focuses on four saleswomen decked out in black uniform dresses who work at Goods Department Store in Sydney, Australia. My favorite character is a high school girl, a temporary worker named Lisa, who falls in love at first sight with a couture cocktail dress. A froth of red pin-spotted white organza with a low neck, a tight bodice, a few deep ruffles over the shoulders. Lisa was experiencing that sudden recognition that a particular frock is not merely pretty, would not merely suit one, but answers to one's deepest notions of one's self. On the cover of The Women in Black is a blurb by Hilary Mantel, who says that this is the book she most often gives as a gift to cheer people up. Do you really need to know anything more? This pandemic has so many of us thinking a lot about food, and when I think of good writing about food, I always think first of the immortal Lori Colwin, who died in 1992. Colwin's unpretentious essays about whipping up the likes of buttered noodles and savory beef stew are collected in two books called Home Cooking and More Home Cooking. There's a slim, sensuous new food memoir coming out this month called Everything is Under Control by Phyllis Grant. Grant has cooked in famous restaurants, but she started out training to be a dancer at Juilliard. When she arrived in the city as a teenager, Grant says she and the other would-be dancers made New York our cafeteria, inhaling white onion, cheddar, and tomato omelets with French fries in fluorescent diners. But soon enough, Grant describes how the demands of dance shamed her and her friends into denying their appetites. Reading about diners and thinking of all those restaurant workers across the country who've lost jobs makes me think of one of my favorite books of all time, Stuart Onan's 2007 novella, Last Night at the Lobster. In precise insider language, Onan writes about a manager named Manny and his staff working the last shifts at a Red Lobster restaurant that the higher-ups have decided to close. It's a great story in miniature about the loss of the casual community that workplaces create, a community that many of us are missing right now. We're into April, which means this is National Poetry Month. I owe this next recommendation to Maria Popova, whose eclectic Brain Pickings blog site spotlighted a Japanese poet named Misuzu Kaneko. A small publisher, Chin Music Press, has brought out a gorgeously illustrated edition of Misuzu's poetry and tragic life story aimed at children and adults, called Are You an Echo? Here's a simple poem called Snowpile that displays Misuzu's celebrated empathetic imagination. Snow on top must feel chilly, the cold moonlight piercing it. Snow on the bottom must feel burdened by the hundreds who tread on it. Snow in the middle must feel lonely, with neither earth nor sky to look at. I want to end where I began, in my beautiful, battered hometown of New York. Most of the great books about New York are books about walking, and that's certainly true of Colson Whitehead's packed personal travelogue, The Colossus of New York, which came out in 2003. Whitehead roams from the Port Authority to the Brooklyn Bridge to the once-dense streets of Midtown. If you're missing the feeling of being lost in a crowd, Whitehead, and really all these writers I've just recommended, offer you the next best thing, the possibility of getting lost in a book.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. If you're interested in issues related to gender or dogs, I think you'll be interested in what my guest Jennifer Finney Borland has to say. She's a prominent voice in the LGBTQ movement and has written extensively about being a trans woman. In her new memoir, she writes that in her early life, when she was living as a boy, then as a man, there were times she found it impossible to express the thing that was in her heart. But the love she felt for dogs was one she never had to hide. And when she felt unlovable, that didn't stop her dogs from loving her. The memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs, which she describes as a book about the seven phases of her life and the dogs she loved at each moment. Borland writes an op-ed column published in the New York Times on alternate Wednesdays, in which she's lately been writing about how the pandemic is affecting her life. She was an advisor on two TV series, Transparent and I Am Kate, about Caitlyn Jenner. From 2013 to 17, she co-chaired the board of directors of the LGBTQ rights group GLAAD. Borland is the inaugural Anna Quinlan Writer in Residence at Barnard College of Columbia University. Jennifer Finney Borland, welcome back to Fresh Air. How are you and your family?
Well, we're doing well enough. I think in this isolation period, people find themselves either too alone or too crowded in with the rest of their family. And we are definitely in the latter camp. There are five of us right now in the house. My wife, my daughter, her fiance, and my brother-in-law. And every day is like Thanksgiving dinner.
And how many dogs do you have now?
We're down to one right now, which I guess is a blessing because, you know, because they get old, and the older they get, the more trouble they are. Actually, they're trouble when they're young, too. I take that back. They're always trouble, but that's why we love them.
Why did you want to frame your life in terms of the dogs you had during each stage of it?
I think there are a couple reasons. One of the things I wanted to write about was this question of what it means to be a woman who had a boyhood. And I want to be really respectful and careful because there are a number of transgender women who would take issue with my using that phrase, having had a boyhood. There are many people who feel that they always were who they are, and to refer to an earlier part of your life differently is really disrespectful. But even though I respect that view, for me, I came out and transitioned in my 40s. And so, I mean, I always knew who I was, but the rest of the world didn't know it. And so I had a kind of period of socialization and you know, walked through the world appearing to be male. So I had this experience, and it's an experience that I now struggle to connect to. And so that's the question. What does it mean to be a woman who had a boyhood? And it struck me that dogs provided the perfect way of talking about that experience because I had a different dog at each of the different moments of my earlier life. So there was the dog that I had when I was a boy. There was a dog for when I was a teenager, and there was one for when I was a cool college boy. And there was one for when I was a husband and a boyfriend and a father. And so in some ways, it's a memoir of masculinity, kind of told the way an expatriate might speak of the country of their birth. There are times when I struggle to remember what it was like to live in that world, but then I remember the dogs and it becomes really clear.
So you tell a story about one of your dogs who was always acting up, was overly sexualized, would hump everybody and everything, would knock down visitors, peed everywhere. But if you tried to tell this dog no, he would just bark. And neutering didn't change things. So you took him to the vet. And the vet said he needs better training, but that there was an experimental hormone therapy you could try. But the vet gave you a warning about how this would change the dog's behavior, that the dog would never be the same dog again. And then you thought about...
Yeah.
You thought about maybe you should take the hormone. So, like, how old were you, and what did you know about hormone therapy? And tell me what was going through your mind then.
We tried to help Matt the Mutt, but nothing we did would help. So we took him to the vet, and the vet said, well, you should train the dog, but here's this experimental protocol. You could have, there was some female hormone, which was supposed to feminize the dog. I remember the vet saying the phrase, he might not be the same dog afterwards. And I remember thinking, so what, he's going to not ask for directions if he is going out to some other dog's house or something? And anyway, I was given this sample of female dog hormones or something. And I'm driving home, and so I'm thinking, you know, the vet has just slipped me the female hormones that I've been hoping for. Because I knew that hormone therapy was a thing that transgender women could take to be restored to themselves. But I also knew that probably I shouldn't be taking the dog's medication. I don't know what that would have done to me. But I thought about it. I really thought about it. I thought, well, I could. What if I took just one? I don't know. Maybe I would have gotten fleas or something. But I threw them in the trash in the end. I thought, no, I can't do this. This is just too crazy. Even for me, this is too crazy. And I came in, and my mother said, how'd it go? And I said, you know, the doctor says we should take him to dog school, which we did, and which had no effect.
How old were you?
I think I was 20. I think this was my senior year at Wesleyan.
So you wanted to take female hormones at that point. You wanted to transition, but felt that you couldn't. And if you did anything, it had to be through subterfuge and secrecy, like taking your dog's hormone pills, which you ultimately decided not to do. So what was that like for you?
It just didn't seem like a careful protocol. In those days, coming out as transgender was unknown territory. At least it was for me. You know, I barely even had a word for the thing that I felt. And as much as I knew I wanted to live my true life, I also felt that if I lived that life, it would almost surely lead to a life of marginality, of violence, and that, you know, I just thought I might well be killed. That there was no place in the world in which I could live. There was no place in the world for me to be. So the idea, the idea of taking dog hormones was probably a non-starter, but even if I'd gone to a doctor and been given the chance to take the medication that I needed, I probably still would have been very reluctant to do it because I was just too afraid. And I thought I'd be wrecking the rest of my life. I thought I would never be loved by anyone except for maybe my dog. I thought that I would never have a family. I would never have a job. It seemed like my best life might well cost me my life. So, you know, I soldiered on, hoping that it would all get better. I also had this belief that love would cure me. I felt that if I were loved deeply enough by someone else, that it would help me get out of myself. And I know that seems like a silly thing to believe, but I think it's very human, and it's not only transgender people who believe that a great love will transform them into the person that they want to be instead of who they are. And the fact that it rarely succeeds, that particular philosophy, doesn't mean that it's any less understandable or human.
So you didn't come out as trans until after you'd been married for probably over a decade, I think around 12 years, and married to a woman. So you were considered by the world and considered by your wife to be a straight couple. What was the turning point for you in deciding that you had to become you, that you couldn't, you had to address who you thought your authentic self was?
Well, it was not exactly one day. It was less of a decision than like an erosion, maybe. You know, I was determined to make the best of the situation. That's all the only way I can describe it, because I thought that coming out as trans was just going to be too hard a life to live. But I remember there was one day when a barrier came down at a railroad crossing, and it was snowing, and I just watched the cars of the freight train going by and started kind of daydreaming and thinking that question, how long are you going to wait before you live your actual life? Eventually the barrier went up, the train disappeared down the tracks, but I was just sitting there in my car in this kind of daze until cars behind me started honking and wondering what was wrong with me. So that was the day I came home and I said to my wife, you know, I think I want to get back into therapy. We had talked a little bit about the gender question before that moment, but that was the moment that I thought, you know, I cannot keep living a life in which I'm not really myself.
What was your wife's reaction?
Well, she's a social worker, so her first reaction was, well, good, good, therapy is a good thing. She wanted me to be happy, but she also felt once it became clear that transition was coming right ahead. Then she had a dilemma where she had to think, well, I have to help the person that I love most in the world at this moment of their crisis, right? But in so doing, I might lose the person that I love. And it's kind of an unsolvable dilemma. And yet here we are, still together, after 32 years of marriage now, 12 as husband and wife, and 20 as wife and wife.
Did she feel that she lost the person who she loved? Did she feel that you became a different person? Or,
I think she felt that way early on. And to be honest, like a lot of trans women in transition, I kind of went into this pink cloud for a little bit. And I was experiencing all the things that I'd wanted to experience but had never been able to be. So, you know, I wore a lot of makeup. I was a real girly girl for a little bit. And I went to a voice therapist who had me speaking in this very feminine voice, and I was taught how to have my sentences go up at the end of every sentence so that I would sound more female. And so I was, I really did spend a time as a kind of an annoying person, actually. And I think my wife was very concerned about that. In time, as I got used to my new body and my new self, I became a little bit more androgynous again, and my voice fell back down here. So in a funny way, I came back to myself, and we came back to each other in that way, although now as two women.
When you were more girly, when you first transitioned, were you more, quote, feminine than your wife was?
I'm not sure. I certainly got more pleasure out of it. I was essentially going through a second adolescence at age 40, and a lot of the kind of trial and error things that girls go through and women go through when they're 5 and 10 and 15 were things that I was having to figure out. And even now there are some things that I'm still trying to figure out, like doing a French braid. Like, I don't know, I'm 61. I begin to think that ship has sailed. I'm probably never going to learn how to do that now. And then there are other things I was told about, things that women do that now I had to do, like I wasn't allowed to have baby back ribs anymore. Like that was a new federal law that women only are allowed to have a little salad. And I just kind of remember thinking, really? Okay, I guess I'll have a little salad. I mean, I'm making fun of that, although, in fact, I do worry about food issues now in a way that I didn't pre-transition. But that's a whole other story, I guess.
Tell me more about that story.
Well, I just, you know, now, I mean, it's so insane. I think to live in this culture means you're constantly being influenced by what the culture wants you to be. And if you're a woman, it means you're supposed to be thin. You're supposed to care about how pretty you are. You're supposed to care about a lot of things that maybe you shouldn't care about as much as the culture says you ought. And as a feminist, I think what I was struggling with was fitting in. I felt like, well, if I'm going to be a woman, do I have to be the kind of woman who I like least? Does that mean that I have to be counting every calorie and kind of constantly deferring to men and constantly being subservient in some ways? I think there's a way in which I felt, well, if I want to fit in, if I want to pass in the world, then this is all the junk that I have to do. And it took me a while before I realized, actually, no, you can fight against that stuff. You've gone to all this trouble to become female. Why would you become anything less than the person you want to be?
Now that you've been out as trans for over 20 years, what do you say some of the fundamental differences between living life as a man? You knew that you wanted to transition, but you still, in describing your past, you describe yourself as having lived as a boy and as a man. So what are some of the fundamental differences between having lived in as a man and living for over 20 years as an out woman? Beyond the physical, just in terms of how you see yourself, how the world sees you, how you make your way through life. I know that's a really big question, but I'm sure it's something you've reflected on.
Yeah. In some ways, the biggest change is not going from male to female. The biggest change is going from someone who has a secret to someone who doesn't have a secret. And if you have a secret that is as profound as the question of who you are, it's something that's going to eat at you all the time. So it used to be I'd wake up in the morning and I'd think, okay, we're going to do the guy thing again now. And now I wake up in the morning and I don't think about it. In a way, gender has become something I think about a whole lot less. I think it's not just the difference between male and female. It's the difference between being young and being middle-aged. And maybe I'm the wrong person to observe those changes. But I try to live my life with courage as best I can. I'll be honest and say that tears lie very close to the surface now when they didn't used to. Maybe it's estrogen. Maybe it's simply being older. You know, you live long enough, you wind up with a lot of arrows in your side. Whatever the reason, it doesn't take much to get me weeping. And quite often weeping just because something wonderful has happened. So my emotions are definitely closer to the surface. But then everything is closer to the surface, and not only because of hormones, but because I'm living in the world with no secrets.
Jennifer Finney Boylan, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I wish you and your family well.
Thank you, Terry, and my love to everybody at WHYY and in the Philadelphia area, the place where I grew up and the station that I listen to. It's been an honor to be here with you.
I really appreciate hearing that. Thank you so much. Jennifer Finney Boylan's new memoir is called Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs.